The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Now we can begin, and I can officially welcome all of you to the Free Library of Philadelphia and to the Ellis Walks Endowed Lecture. I'm Leslie Miller, and I'm one of the vice presidents of the Free Library Foundation's Board of Directors. The Ellis Walks Endowed Lecture honors Mr. Walks' commitment to the field of history and, of course, to our author's event series. I can't think of a better person to sponsor this evening because we all know that Ellis never misses Jim Lehrer's NewsHour. Like Mr. Walks, the Free Library is also strongly committed to promoting the study and understanding of our past, which, as we all know, helps us to better understand today's current events. Here at Parkway Central, the history collection includes more than 100,000 titles documenting world history and social history from antiquity to the present. The collection is further supplemented by nearly 300 journal titles and a collection of essential research databases, all of which can be found at freelibrary.org. I'd urge all of you, if you haven't done so, to take a look sometime. Tonight, it's my personal pleasure to introduce an individual that I've been lucky enough to get to know over the years. Moderator, news anchor, editor, author, and just wonderful human being, Jim Lehrer, who's here to speak to us tonight about his role in the history of presidential debates, which form the basis for his latest book, Intention City. Often called the Dean of Moderators, he's presided over 11 presidential and vice presidential debates. He's written 20 novels, 2 memoirs, and 3 plays. And in his spare time, he's been the producer and co-host of the PBS NewsHour, where you can still see him on occasional Friday nights. But perhaps Jim's most memorable accomplishment is the astonishing train call that he shared with some of us right here a year ago. And if you're a good audience, he might just well reprise it here again tonight. As an added bonus, here to interview Jim is David Brooks, the acclaimed author and columnist known to all of us. In fact, I'm sure that many of you in this audience were here with me last March when David talked about his latest book, The Social Animal. I think all of us would agree that we're very happy that he's chosen to return to the library so quickly. Needless to say, ladies and gentlemen, this is a very special night at the Free Library to have two such distinguished journalists in our presence, and it is my pleasure to welcome both Jim Lehrer and David Brooks. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure for me to be here with Jim and a pleasure to be in the role of Predator for once. As you know, our show is now called the PBS NewsHour. Earlier it was called the NewsHour with Mark Shields and David Brooks and some other people. We actually wanted to call our segment, this was Mark's idea, we wanted to call our segment Brooke Shields, which we thought. But Jim shot that one down. Now it's Shields and Brooks. It should be Brooks and Shields, but it's in deference to Mark's longevity on the show. Now it's Brooks and Shields. Before that, it was Shields and Gigot. And then before that, it was Shields and Gergen. Before that, it was Shields and Coolidge, I think it started out. It actually originated as Shields and Aquinas. I'm the rookie. I'm the youngster. But I've been doing it this month, 10 years, as a regular on Friday nights. In fact, almost to the day, which, as you know, is half my life. And the general rule is we're the ones who get interrogated by this fellow, and we never get to ask any questions until tonight. And so the gazelles get to eat the lions. And I thought I would not make it easy on Jim. And so my first question is, what's the square root of 346?
I'll get back to you on that.
Now, we're here to talk about Jim's book, Attention City. Jim is the only wordsmith who took the title of his book from George H.W. Bush, not one of the great wordsmiths of our time. But let's talk just quickly about the debates, and let's just do some basic logistics. Quickly, how do you get the call? What do you think? And then how do you amass the questions? Just how do you do the job?
Well, the call, I've gotten the call 11 times, and they're each time it came slightly differently. First time, I just couldn't believe it. It was in 1988. I got a call from somebody from the debate commission and said, would you moderate the debate between George H.W. Bush and Michael Dukakis? The guy who called me, he didn't say it, but he suggested that I was not the number one choice. But I couldn't believe it. I mean, I was in Mississippi moderating emceeing a dinner in honor of Eudora Welty when I got the call. And I should have put this in the book. I'll do that.
There's the paperback.
I'll put it in. I'll do it in a paperback. And I got the call. I was staying in a rooming house. And a rooming house. It's somebody's I was in somebody's private home. And I answered the phone, and the guy said, "Well, you might." And I said, "Oh my God! Oh yeah. Well, yeah. Well, I've got to. I think so. Let me talk to Kate, that's my wife, and I'll get back to you." And of course, he says, "What are you going to talk to Kate about?" And I said, "I'm going to ask her whether I ought to." You know, something stupid. At any rate, I go immediately to the hall where I'm to do this black tie dinner thing for Eudora, who was an old friend. I took her aside immediately, and I said, "Eudora, they just called. You'll never believe this. They just called and asked me to moderate this next presidential debate." And she said, "Well, it's about time." And I said, "So you think I ought to do it?" "You have to for your country." I said, "Yeah, but blah, blah, blah." And she said, "Don't you worry. I will help you do this." It was great. I don't know why in the hell I didn't put that in a book. But every one of these, one time where I ended up doing all of the debates, moderating all the debates between Bill Clinton and Bob Dole. And that happened because they first called me and said, "Will you do the first debate?" I said, "Yes." And by then I'd done a few. And then about 3 days went by, and I was at Williamsburg about to moderate a discussion among the leadership of the Congress, and got another one of these calls through an intermediary. Said, "Well, the negotiators, the handlers for Dole and Clinton are in a huge fight over who's going to moderate the other debates. And one of them wanted Oprah Winfrey. One of them wanted, you know, whatever, whatever, whatever." And so they took a break and asked me to call you. It's a guy from the NewsHour. It was Les Crystal, who was then the executive producer of the NewsHour, and said, "Well, they can agree on you for the first." Now they said, "Well, will you do all of them so we can go home?" Because it was late. I said, "Yeah." So I mean, it wasn't because I was such a marvelous Wawa. It was just because I couldn't agree on anybody else. And then another time, the same thing. But the thing that always remains constant, David, seriously, is from the first time I got asked, to the last time I got asked, until the last moment I said thank you and good night at the end, which was 2008, John McCain and Barack Obama. There's one constant throughout that period, from the time you get the first call till you say good night, and it's absolute fear.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Is it the same as Obama McCain versus the first one?
Always. Because the risks are, the stakes are so high, that makes everything connected with it very, very high. All the risks for everybody involved, particularly the candidates, obviously. In fact, right in the first part of the book, I tell the story about that first debate I did with Michael Dukakis and George H.W. Bush, and Kate and I, my wife and I, were in a hotel waiting to go be picked up to take go to the hall and do the debate. At that time, it was still the old-fashioned format of a moderator and three journalist panelists. And I had, we'd met, and I knew what the questions were going to be, and I had them in a folder, and I was holding them like this, and we were waiting on, and I was shaking. I said to Kate, I said, I'm just beside myself. I mean, you know, I'm just nervous as hell, and I'm just whined. Kate looked at me, and she said, I tell you something, you think you got a problem? Think what it's like for those two candidates. They do one thing wrong. It can be a little thing that's physical, or one word can come out wrong, and they can lose the presidency of the United States. In other words, get a grip.
Right. Yeah.
But it didn't help.
There's a moment you describe in the book, this wasn't one you moderated, but it was the Carter Ford debate.
Yeah.
I think it was right here in Philadelphia, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, the Walnut Theater. Yeah.
When the sound goes out,
yeah.
And they act completely unnaturally. They just stand there.
He stood like a stage like this, the podium over here. So here was Ford. Here was Carter. And the panelists were in front, and the stage was larger than this. And Edward Newman was the moderator. And I quote him here again, and he wrote it in his own book, and I quoted it in mine. Newman said, we all saw them. They just stood there, you know, frozen. And Newman said that he went over to both of them individually and said, Mr. President, in one case, it was Jimmy Carter, or no, Gerald Ford, and or Governor, you know, I can get you a chair. You want a chair? And Newman said not only did they not want a chair, they wouldn't even acknowledge that I asked them if they wanted a chair. And they were just frozen in time. And they both had one of the great experiences I had, David, as you know, was not just doing the debates, but I also had the opportunity, and I would call it a privilege, to interview just about all of the candidates who ever did a presidential or vice presidential debate about their debate experiences. And so I asked both, you know, years later, both Ford and Carter, and they both agreed that that was the worst day of their lives. And I asked Carter, I said, well, do you think, you know, anybody got, was there, what did it, either of you, did either you, either of you feel the other one scored better than the other, and how you stood, you know, scared to death for 27 minutes? Uh-huh. And he said, no. He said, I think it demonstrated to the American people that a quality in both of us that was not very positive.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, amen, yeah. Mr. President.
I was quite taken with the interviews you did with everyone, I guess except for Lloyd Benson you didn't
get a chance to talk to. Didn't get to Lloyd Benson, because Lloyd Benson, by the time I got around to it, Lloyd Benson was ill. Had a stroke, and he very much wanted to talk to me, but Al Gore wouldn't talk, and I understand why. He just he didn't want to talk about 2000. Someday he will, but that's an open sore, understandably. And Ross Perot wouldn't talk to me. I've got a little story about that in there, but anyhow.
Everybody else did. Did you find their performances were accurate, or were they self-delusional?
Yes and no. Well, here's the deal. David and Mark and the three of us have talked about all this privately before. You couldn't do what the three of us do if you didn't have respect for the people who serve in public life, who run for office, and who govern the country. So we have an innate respect and admiration for public servants. So so I don't look at politicians with askance as though they're somehow animals beneath human beings. Quite the contrary. I think it takes a lot of courage and a lot of everything that matters for people to hold them to put themselves forward in public in politics. So as a consequence, when I sit to interview these candidates about their debate performances, first thing that struck me loud and clear, here again, it's not in the book, is just how there are no accidents at that level of American politics. You don't go through the process of being of running, and usually, there are a few exceptions. Every one of them has held public office before. They've been scrutinized, and they've been vetted and vented and everything, and yelled at and screamed at. As Jack Kemp said, professional football was a terrific, terrific training for for politics, because he'd had his head handed to him and been beaten up and kicked and everything else. But at any rate, they were all professional politicians at the ultimate. They played politics at the ultimate level. And when I talked to them about their debates, I waited in every case, with one couple of exceptions. The debates had happened years before, so they had time to think about it. And they loved talking about it. They loved to talk about it. Like, they would be like, you know, a bus driver talking about a good run to Houston or something like that. Yeah. I mean, it was craft talk. It was shop talk. Yeah. And, for the most part. Yeah. Now, the no comes is that, nobody wanted to admit, with one exception, of all the candidates I talked to, nobody wanted to admit that they had any prepared one-liners. They wanted to, you know, I asked Ronald Reagan the line that, you know, they used on Mondale. Oh, I don't want to use age, you know, as an issue, you know, because of my candidate's inexperience and youthfulness and all that sort of stuff. And I said, Mr. President, did you have that ready? Oh no, just kidding.
Yeah.
There was another line that there you go again. And I said, oh yeah, but you were ready for that. Oh no, it just came to me. He said, you know, no. In Benson's case, even though I wasn't able to talk to Benson, Benson did several interviews between the time of the debate and the time he got sick. And I, of course, read all those interviews. And he said his thing, you know, the thing to Dan Quayle. Jack Kennedy was my friend, you know, and you're a senator, you're no Jack Kennedy. And Benson said, no, that just came to me. Well, the fact is, I asked some of the people who worked for Benson just to get the feel of what the deal was. And the fact is this. Quayle had said this many, many times during the campaign. He had used that line. Hey, you know, they say I'm not experienced. Well, Jack Kennedy had less experience than I did, than Kennedy did when he was elected president. And that during the prep for the debate, one of Benson's guys said, you know, you might want to think of saying something like, hey, you're no Jack Kennedy. And, but Benson said, no, he didn't say it to me, but he said it to some others. The only candidate who, when I asked him directly, did you work on one-liners? And he, big smile, said, it was Bill Clinton. He said, you bet we did. He said, I had all kinds of one-liners for everything. And I tried to work them in best I could, but it was stop talk for him. You know, now obviously you have one-liners, you know, and you want to use them, and but he was the only one who would really cop out to it.
One-liners. Yeah, we'll get to Clinton again in another context, a famous interview with you, but just on the debates, you know, when you started doing this with Dukakis, last one you did was Obama. In the course of those years, journalism has changed, and the way people are interviewed have changed. And there's a lot more gotcha, and in good ways and bad. I mean, I think Tim Russert pioneered a style of questioning that was different maybe than what existed 10, 15 years ago. Do you think you've stayed the same, or have you adjusted as the culture has adjusted, or are you happy with the way the media has shifted the questioning?
I'm very comfortable just to be straight about it, I'm very comfortable with the way I interview people. And I'm the reason I'm comfortable, because I've been doing it the same way for 36 years or more.
Yeah.
And because of the partnership with Robert McNeil, first thing Robert McNeil said, has Robin ever been here? Has McNeil ever been to the Free Library? He's a terrific guy. Anyway, when we started the program in 1975, it had the worst title in the history of television. It was called the Robert McNeil Report. But yeah. That's neither here nor there. And I was the Washington correspondent. Anyhow, Robin said to me, he said, "Now, Jim," and he and I had done some work together. We knew each other. We had done some, we'd done the Watergate hearings together. We'd done some other things. We'd gotten to be, we're already friends, personal friends as well as professional friends. We started the Nightly Show. He said, "Look, we are going to do civil discourse. That is the business we are in. And it's very important that everybody who works for us knows that. So join me in telling everybody and practicing it, and everybody understands that. And the people who come as guests must be told that they are there to participate in civil discourse. If you want to shout at somebody, go on somebody else's program. We're not going to put it. You want to talk over somebody, do that on somebody else's program." So, and that has just been the way we've done it. Now, when it comes to the debates, I have been criticized, and I point this out in the book. I mean, somebody unfortunately said this in print that, well, it was some debate that I moderated. It was Gore, George W. Bush. "Oh, Lara moderated that debate like it was Sherry Hour at Harvard or something like that." And somebody else said, "Oh, and his questions, my God, you could have gotten somebody off the street could ask better questions than that." So, you know, I've taken my hits. But I have a very set, and I don't mean correct, but set view of what a debate moderator's role is, right, as distinguished from a reporter's role in interviewing people. Debate moderator, I believe, is there to facilitate the candidates to talk. And I have a bunch of rules. Don't ever get a debate moderator who doesn't already have the best job he or she will ever get and is coming to audition for a better one. Don't ever get a debate moderator who wants to be rich and famous, because all you have to do, see, I could, let's say David's the candidate, and I could just ask him, it hasn't been brought up. Let's say it hasn't been brought up. Say, "Who is the Prime Minister of Uzbekistan?" "Well, what about Upper Volta? When did Upper Volta cease to exist and that other thing?" And you could just make fools of people. And that's gotcha. That's gotcha stuff. Right. But my view of debate moderating is that the debate is about the issues of the campaign. And I am fastidious about it, and I've been criticized for this. I don't introduce new subjects. As just as cardinal rule of my own. Nobody else has ever told me that. There are no rules like that. And because I think that by the time you have those debates, they're in late September, early October, the election is on, 90% of the people have already decided for whom they're going to vote or are leaning very strongly. And the issue then is for the most of the people, the millions and millions, 90, 100 million people watch these debates. And they're not there to find out the particular person's view about lockboxes and Social Security. They already know that if they've been following a campaign. They want to take the measure of the individual. Can you imagine that person sitting at the desk in the Oval Office? Can you imagine that person? How would this person go about making a decision about sending Americans into harm's way? How would he or she react to another 9/11, to a Katrina, to all those kinds of things? David, you're much more knowledgeable about this than I am. But the fact of the matter is, I believe that 90% of being president of the United States is dealing with the unexpected, not the expected. You might vote for somebody because you might think, "Oh, I'm for Billy Bob because he will put Social Security in a lockbox." But the fact of the matter is, look what happened to George W. Bush, number one example. You know, there was no, by the time Al Gore and George W. Bush, I moderated all those debates. By the time they got to September, early October, you could barely, there was no daylight between them on any of the issues. Both of them had, one of them started on the right, one of them started on the left, and by the time they got to the fall, you couldn't tell one from the other except by their accents. And there were no sharp corners because they had religiously and with dedication and success gotten rid of them.
Yet,
so then it became other things.
But yeah. The least Lehrer-esque question ever asked in a presidential debate was revelatory in some sense, and you write about it in the book, which was Bernie Shaw's Kitty Dukakis question. What was interesting to me, what I learned in the book, was how anguished he's been ever since he asked that question.
That's right. He's still upset about it. You remember, you know the question. He asked Michael Dukakis if Kitty Dukakis was raped and murdered, would you be in favor of the death penalty for the perpetrator? And Dukakis said, no, Bernard, I would not. And then he gave a little treatise on capital punishment without any emotion or whatever. And the point that I make in the book, and that not, I don't make it, but others make, the question, there were, it was in the old format, but there were three panelists, journalists, Margaret Warner, who now works for us, Andrea Mitchell, who then worked for NBC, still does, and Ann Compton, who worked for ABC then and still works for ABC, and Bernie, who was the moderator. And the three panelists tried to talk Bernie out of the question. And they at least not use her name. And he said no. He got very angry about the fact that they would even ask about it. And there's a backstory about it that's in the book that I will not bore you with. But the important thing about it is, the reason it's interesting, at least to me, and anybody in our business, is that here you have five or six of the top journalists in America, and they were all present at the same meetings, and they came away with and hearing different things. And as I point out, I make in the book is that it's a good thing for those of us in journalism to remember that happens to real people too, and it's part of a learning process. But Bernie believes very strongly that he was a proper question. And I asked Dukakis about it, and Dukakis said that he agreed. He said he thought it was fair. He said the issue was his answer. And George H.W. Bush said to me, he said, well, what he should have done is just said, I would have grabbed the guy and strangled him. Given an emotional, an emotional answer rather than a... Yeah. An intellectual answer.
Okay. Now, I have many questions about your childhood and what led you to become, your relations to your early pets, but I'll skip those. I'm going to ask one more, and then we'll open it up, so think of your own questions. And this is generally about questioning.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things when there's a debate that Jim is not moderating, sometimes we'll be watching on the NewsHour in the studio, and Mark and I are talking about, oh, that was a good answer, that was a good answer, and Jim is saying, oh, that was a good question, that was not a good question. So we're evaluating different things. And so all of us are at some point in our lives in the questioning business, trying to elicit a conversation or information. What are some rules, some Lehrer rules on how to ask good questions?
Well, the first rule is to ask one question at a time. Mm-hmm. Don't say, what is your position on lockboxes? And by the way, what day is it?
Yeah,
and
right.
And do you think we should bring the troops home from Afghanistan?
Right.
Just ask one question at a time. Ask it in with no preface. Eliminate preface if you possibly can. Just a very straightforward question. So you get, if you ask a remote, circuitous question, you are inviting remote, circuitous answers. So it. The other thing, the other rule is, which is crucial to me, is that the questions that you got to do your homework. You really must do your homework, but not so you can write terrific questions. I mean, somebody on the street really could write terrific questions, but only an experienced interviewer, only an experienced moderator, end quote, can ask informed questions based on what has been said. In other words, you do your homework so you'll be comfortable enough to listen to the answers. and react to them. I mentioned this in the book. I say this all the time. My favorite example of this, made-up example, is I ask, Senator, should we sell more grain to Cuba? Yes, Jim, I think we should sell more grain to Cuba. But before we do that, we should bomb Havana. And I come in quickly with, what kind of grain, Senator? Because that was the next question I'd written down. And didn't listen to the answer. And you watch television over a period of time, or listen to radio over a period of time, and you watch, you'll notice people who weren't paying attention to the answer. And they just move on. And that, to me, is fatal. Not fatal. It can be fatal. I've done it myself. I know it can be, because I've missed things before, as David knows. Missed something huge once. Should I tell that story?
You're going to Clinton's story?
Clinton's story. On the day the Monica Lewinsky story broke, I had scheduled an in-depth interview with the president as a preview to the State of the Union address, which was 10 days away. And it was scheduled for like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. That morning, I woke up at our Washington home and went out in my bare feet to get the paper, as I always do, and picked it up. The headline says, President accused of having affair with 21-year-old White House intern. And I yelled out into the atmosphere, holy Wawa! Then didn't know whether there was going to be an interview, I didn't know what was going to happen. But finally, 3 o'clock, the president had not made a statement at all after the thing, some written statement that really wasn't a statement. So finally I did the interview, and I did the first interview about it, and my question was, Mr. President, it was something really dynamite, like, Mr. President, newspapers say you had an law with an intern or whatever. Is that true? And he said, there is no improper relationship. I said, so you're saying there was no sexual relationship? Well, I mean, there were several questions before I got to that. And anyhow, I lasted for 7 or 8 minutes, and then I went on to Bosnia, and which was other stuff, and I came back to it at the end. Well, yeah, it was a big deal, huge deal, because it was the first time he'd spoken, and I had no idea what he was going to say beforehand. Nothing had leaked ahead of time. I didn't know what he was going to say. I didn't even know if the story was true. I didn't know if he was going to say, hey, somebody's made this thing up, and I don't know what the hell is going to happen. But anyhow, I got through the interview, and we had something I'm very proud of in public broadcasting. It turned out, I'm telling you a hell of a lot more than you want to know, but I don't mind. I don't mind if you know this. The three commercial television network anchor men were all in Havana, of all places. Not because it was bombed there, but because the Pope was there. And so at 3 o'clock, when our interview was set to go, the ABC guy comes to our executive producer there in the Roosevelt Room, which is right next to the White, right next to the Oval Office, where we're going to do the interview, and says, hey, you know, ABC, we would love to run that interview live. Well, it's unheard of. I mean, this would be an exclusive deal. We could have taken that tape and run home to our studio and run it live and run it on tape at 6 o'clock as a news hour exclusive. And so he came to me, the executive producer came to me, Les Kirsten came to me and said, well, what do you think we ought to do? And I said, oh, God. And then somebody, CBS said they want to do it. NBC wanted to run it. CNN, everybody wanted to run it. So we kind of took deep breaths and swore on the public broadcasting manual and said, yeah, we're public broadcasting, let them have it live. So the whole world saw my interview, and our exclusive went out the window. But at any rate, I get back to the office after the interview, and Kate, my wife, is on the phone. The minute I get back to the office, and she said, "Oh God, it was terrific. You're a wonderful husband, and you can come home tonight and all that." And we were talking with the Watts earlier.
That's not what Hillary said.
That's not what Hillary said. We have three daughters, and Kate said to me, but Amanda noticed, she said to tell you that she thinks that you need to know that you were asking the questions in the past tense, but the president was answering them in the present tense. I thought it was over for me. I thought there would never be another news hour with my name or having anything to do with it. I thought, oh my God. I was here again. I was doing exactly what I said earlier you're not supposed to do. I was clearly very, very tense about this. I was really a tension city about it. And I was hearing what I expected to hear once he denied it. And I got away with it at the time because it was within 24 hours he had made another statement and I didn't get my head handed to me. I thought I was going to hear about this for the rest of my professional career, but I talk about it myself now. They don't have to beat up on me anymore about it.
I will say for somebody who answers a lot of questions, it is phenomenally hard to do to moderate a 14-minute discussion, even if it should be 18 minutes. But one of the things you find is I find that sometimes if you're on one of the other shows, they ask the same question 8 times. So the conversation just stays in the same place.
Right. Yeah.
And often, as you say, they have the questions asked beforehand. They've got them written down. Doesn't matter what you say.
Right.
They're going to run through them. Sometimes the questions are so long you can go to the men's room and come back and you're still in the middle of them.
Sure.
And I say this all the time, for Mark and I, the 60% of the quality answer is us, but 40% is you and the whole gestalt of the show. It's interesting how very different you are.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
And Jim has a trick, which I detect, I don't know if you're conscious, where you just pick out 2 words the other person said, and then you just bounce it off. So you have no time to think, because he's just given you 2 words. But it is the crucial 2 words of what Mark just said, and then I've got to go on.
Well, the hardest question is that I asked Mark and David is, you agree with him, David?
Yeah.
Would you say it the same way?
Yeah, that's actually not a hard question. let's questions from the floor, and I think there are microphones coming down the aisles. Let's go start in the back over there.
I wonder whether you have some sort of assessment of the current ongoing Republican candidates debate in terms of the questions and the general demeanor of it.
I'm not sure everybody heard this. The question was, how many times have I been to Philadelphia and to give you a semi-direct answer to your question, the purpose of those debates is to weed the field, and it's happening right before our very eyes. And I think, for instance, in 2008, because you had no incumbent, there were 40 primary debates with the Democrats and the Republicans. And they tried every kind of, they did everything but put them underwater with people standing on their heads. They tried every kind of format, everything in the world. I think that's good. I think that's fine. I think I have a couple of problems and my major problem with these primary debates, which would be easily corrected, and they're beginning to correct it. Not anything to do with me, but I've said this many times, said it in my book, in fact. I think if you're going to weed out the candidates that are going to appear in a debate, then you should do it before they go on the stage. In other words, you should create a criteria and say, okay, Santorum, you don't make it. Whatever. once
the guy's
once,
from Pennsylvania, come on. Yeah.
But once you get on this, God, I wish I'd thought of another example.
He's from Pittsburgh.
I thought I was here at the Free Library of Wichita, Kansas. Yeah. No. At any rate, what my point is that once you do the debate, once you invite the candidates, you should treat everybody fairly, exactly the same. In other words, you shouldn't put them in the middle of the stage based on the polls. You should give Joe your very best to make sure that everybody gets about the same amount of time, and not use the debate itself as a way to discriminate. I mean, back in 2008, the Democrats did that a lot. I mean, not the Democrats themselves, but the people who did the debates, and they did it. But I must say, to Wolf Blitzer's credit, Wolf Blitzer did the a second Republican debate this time on CNN, and I mean, this man went through moderator hell, trust me. He had tweets and Twitters and Facebooks and wah-wah coming at him from all directions. He had eight candidates, and he was trying his best to, you know, and I said to somebody, you know, that man must have lost 5 pounds during that 90-minute debate. But he hung in there to make that fair, and that's my only view, and the bottom line is, like last night, I said to David, and I were talking privately a moment ago, and I told David that I felt that was a kind of a tribute to two things. First of all, the format, sitting around a table, and that does matter. It's really hard to sit next to somebody and call them a rotten SOB. You would say, well, you're sometimes a rotten SOB. Whatever. It just changes the tone. And the other thing they did was stay on one subject and one subject alone. And that forced everybody to stay on that subject, and the longer they stayed, the more they revealed about what candidates did and didn't know about it. The subject of the economy, which happens to be the single most important thing going on in the world today. So I thought that in terms of the purpose, I thought last night was another step toward fulfilling its purpose in a good way. I don't know if you agree with me.
Yeah, I do. Okay. Now, I should mention you used the word Wawa a couple times. In this part of the country, that's a convenience store. And our event is sponsored by the Wawa Corporation.
Okay, I'll come up with something else.
Sir.
My question is to both of you gentlemen. In the years that you have been interviewing politicians, have any of them come back at you in limited access or cut off access because of something you asked them?
No. I don't think. I don't have any. Nothing leaps out at me. I bet it's probably happened. But I can't think of a really. I can't think of a really major example. That I've had candidates, or not candidates, but public people, jump me after the interview. Some guys who household name, such a household name, I'm not going to tell you who it was. Just got up and started yelling at me, and he was upset because, you've got two sides of the argument, and eventually you have to end it. So one side's going to get the last word. And this guy believed that he deserved the last word, and he didn't get it. And he was a hothead anyhow. And a very brilliant man and a very well-known public servant. But he started screaming at me, you know, and he used, but he even used profanity in my presence. And
Never happened in the Marine Corps.
Yeah, you learned that. Yeah, because I was a Marine, I didn't even notice. Yeah.
I'm struck. It's a little different on the print side because you're avoidable. And I would say when I would write negative columns about the Bush administration, often I'd go 6 months before an invite would come.
Is that
and
right?
There were periods. The Obama administration is the reverse. If you write a really tough column, they'll call you in for re-education. And I actually told the president once, you have a very perverse incentive structure, because every time I say something mad or nasty about you, I'm sitting here in the Oval, and it's pretty good. Let's try somewhere on this side of the room, right there in the middle, about two-thirds back.
First, I really appreciate the NewsHour and what you've done. My question is really for either of you. Do you see a way out of the hyper-partisanship and gridlock that seems to be paralyzing Washington today?
Mr. Brooks, you've been asked a hell of a question.
Well, I'll give my 30 seconds, but then you do have to answer. You know, we go through cycles. You know, my hero, Alexander Hamilton, was shot by the vice president. That's a polarizing act, I would say. Civil War. The odd thing about the current moment is that we went through a 30-year cycle of increasing polarization, and it was supposed to turn, and it hasn't. It's only magnified. And I think there are multiple causes of that. And to some degree, the country is polarizing. The number of counties where one party or another has a landslide majority has doubled in a generation. Republicans moving into Republican places, Democrats moving into Democratic places. Nonetheless, the political culture is more polarized in the country by a long shot. And a lot of that, many people point to a lot of different factors. I would emphasize bourbon. People no longer drink with one another. Airplanes, they go home, voting schedules in the Senate, which allow you to go home. But to me, it's ultimately leadership is part of it. The way you get promoted in the Congress is through raising money, and those people tend to be more partisan. And then the biggest, and I would say the most fundamental difference, is a different conception of how sure people are about themselves. If you go through life thinking, I'm pretty wrong a lot of the time, then you think, I need my opponents to counteract my own ignorance. But if you go through life thinking, I'm pretty special, then your opponents are just in the way. And I happen to think we've have different conceptions of ourselves than we did 50 years ago. And that's the fundamental reason.
I can't do any better than that. The only thing I would add, and it's a kind of obvious thing, but it puts me in a minority when I say this, is that I don't think it's permanent. I think it's the result of certain realities. When you've got as many people unemployed as there are now, and people thinking they're not going to be able to find another job, and you got people who are worried now. They've worked all their lives and they've lost their homes. And they're not sure they're going to get another home. And there are the people who worked thinking that their kids are going to go to college and now they're not going to be able to provide it, et cetera. These are all real things. And when you have real hurt, not made up political hurt, real hurt, what that does is, and the politicians don't seem, it doesn't matter whether they're right wing or left wing or moderates or Republicans or Democrats, they don't seem to be able to, I don't hear what they're saying. They don't seem to get it. They don't seem to understand my problem. Then you tend to look elsewhere for an answer. And you end up talking, listening to some people on the edges, the left or the right, that you might not otherwise have ever listened to. Or you might not because the hostility of politics grows up, all the reasons that David mentioned, it really rises when there is a bad reality on the ground among the electorate. It can be an electorate in a congressional district, it can be in the national electorate or whatever, because people are looking for answers. They're looking for an alternative. They're looking for a way to get this fixed. The mainstream people can't do it. Well, maybe this right winger's got an idea, or maybe this left winger's got an idea, and those views get delivered in very angry terms, because they are in fact angry. The people are, angry people tend to congregate with angry people, and that's.
Other questions. right here.
I was in a conversation with someone today about the state of our country and this seeming economic crisis, except that we see a lot of people carrying large shopping bags and buying. But we then talked about some of the situations and wondered how much the media contributes to the malaise that is gripping our country. In other words, does the media create some of these discussions or these interpretations? How much of that is real and how much of that has been created by the media, or do you think that's just a figment of our imagination?
Well, I think it's a figment of your imagination. I am not. David can attest to this. If I need a witness here, I am not a knee-jerk defender of the press. I mean, I am in fact an outspoken critic of the press, and I don't have any hesitancy at all criticizing the press. But 90% of what causing the malaise or whatever it is, the result of facts that have been reported accurately for the most part in the press. You might possibly, it's conceivable that you could get away with making up something, slanting something in a straight news organization once or twice or whatever, but eventually you're going to get caught and you're going to get fired. Most of the people who practice journalism in the mainline journalism organizations are as professional about what they do as you doctors in this room are, as you lawyers are about you, as you money managers are about you, as whatever else, teachers, whatever you have. Whatever. And they take this very, very seriously. And the problem is that if you report what's going on and you report that it's bad, then it's, oh my God, it's the creation of the media. That's just not true. It's the facts that are creating that situation. There are very few instances.
But do they fan the fires?
They what?
Do they fan the fires?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. You cannot, if you report a bad situation, that in and of itself fans the fires. I mean, but that's just the nature of a democratic society. Democratic society is based on telling people what's going on, whether it's good or bad. And fanning the fires is what the First Amendment's all about. People do that. Not straight reporters, but the reporting. In the beginning, there's a news story. And then somebody takes the news story and analyzes it, and somebody gives their opinion about it and fans the fires. But the beginning, those beginning news stories are done by professionals who have no motives other than just try to get the information out. And yes, for some cases, it's going to arouse people to do fanning fire things. But if you don't do that, if you say, "Oh well, my God, this is going to upset people," then you're no longer in journalism. You're in the God business.
If I could actually tell two quick 30-second anecdotes on this subject of the media and society. I was at a conference of sexologists, people who study sex. A more boring group of people you never want to meet, by the way. But I learned that in the 60s, the media coverage of sex changed a lot. But actual sexual behavior did not change as much as you'd think. It was World War I and World War II that changed actual behavior. It was the reality. Yeah. And then my other anecdote is I was having dinner one day at a diner in Long Island City in Queens. And there was women in the next booth who had big bouffant hairdos, long painted nails, thick Queens accents. And I was thinking, I'm sitting here about a mile or two from the headquarters of NBC, CBS, and NBC. Nobody talks this way. Nobody dresses this way. So it's your immediate reality that shapes who you are, I think, more.
Amen.
For both of you gentlemen, what are your potential predictions, hopes, and fears in terms of what might be the dominant media for the dissemination of news over the next 20 years? Where would you like to see things go? Where do you see things going?
Well, I think it's all of the above. No, I mean, we're in the middle of a revolution. and ask Muammar Gaddafi what it's like to be in the middle of a revolution. It's hell. The revolution in journalism is all over the lot. We're grasping for ways to get factual information out in a way that people will believe it, and that it's factual and it's and all the things that I started to say wah-wah, but David won't let me do that anymore. And so, yes, there are people, and I'm one of them, who get a lot of news off the internet. I mean, I go to Google News when I'm traveling, but I still read
New York Times.
Got him. And I do all the normal. I do, but everybody has their own. Here's what's so neat about it. It's not quite as neat as it ought to be yet, but can be the is everybody can get. Everybody has a way to get the news that's most convenient to them. And for some people, it is the pink iPod with their name engraved on it. For some, it's a television screen the size of this one of these walls. For others, it's reading something like a Kindle or an iPad or whatever. For others, it's the old-fashioned newspaper. It's all kinds of. It's going to be a mix, and that mix is growing all the time. There are people sitting over there somewhere out in Northern California right now inventing a new way to get the news out and all that, and we still don't know. What we have to do, bottom line here, and this is a whole subject, and I'll just end my piece of it by saying to you, is that those of us who are in the serious journalism business can't let the technologies of the future affect our journalism. We've got to look upon the technologies like we looked upon the printing press, like we looked upon coming of the microphone, like we looked upon the coming of the television camera. Those were devices for the dissemination of information required for the electorate to have an informed opinion so they can cast an informed vote in elections. That is what journalism is all about. And there's all those other things, you know, periphery things, but that's the core mission of journalism. So those of us who are in that business cannot allow ourselves to lose sight of that.
I then. The only thing I'd add is just an evolution in my thinking over the last 5 years. 5 years ago, I thought it was all getting shorter and shallower. But now, and this pertains to what the New York Times does, what the library does, what the Robin McNeil report does, whatever it's called. And it's an increasing conviction that there are certain elemental facts that the things that are longer are better remembered, and they have a bigger impact. And so far from chasing out long-form journalism, we're actually seeing sort of a renaissance in long-form journalism. And so I would recommend, say, for example, two websites, one called Arts and Letters Daily and one called The Browser, thebrowser.com, which have links to 6,000, 8,000-word essays. And they come out every day, and there's a lot of good stuff. Because essentially people want to be able to remember what they consume more than 5 minutes later. And so that ineluctable fact will never go away. So we have time for one more question, maybe right here in the middle.
What do you think the effect of the ubiquitous polling has on political campaigns?
The what kind of polling?
The polls that are constantly published or talked about.
Well, they're just the general polling, the proliferation of polling.
Yes.
Well, there's no question they have an effect because there are people in the political world who are following them all the time, and people can mount a new strategy or change an argument or take an edge off a question or an answer based on what about what the polls are. But generally speaking, polls are if you just keep in mind what a poll is. A poll is literally it's stopping the river right then for a moment and telling you what people think about a given thing or a given person or a given issue at that moment, and it's dependent on the question. You can, I mean, David and I could sit and, well, I'll bet you we could figure out a way to poll every one of you, have a poll on the same subject, and ask essentially the same question but in different words and come up with diametrically different answers. I mean, so the polling is the end result is important, but you've got to also understand the poll, and I would urge everybody who reads polls to go back. Here, it's all available. You can go back and look at the methods, read about the methods of the polls. And we have a rule at the NewsHour, we don't report polling results as news. We report them as interesting sidelights in a discussion or something like that, because I'm the one who has that problem with them, because I think they sometimes can be part of a self-fulfilling start to say wah-wah again, and but they're not evil. They're interesting. They're important. But they're not everything. You just got to keep them in perspective, frankly.
Okay, the book is Tension City. I think Jim will be out there. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David. Thank you very much.
Please join us upstairs for the book signing.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.